Hello and welcome to Bone Up, the podcast all about bones, how we make them, why we break them, and if we fully understand them. I'm David Armstrong.
Hi, and I'm Richie Abel. And over this series, we're going to be exploring osteoporosis, bones, what we know and what we're yet to discover. And we hope you will join us on the journey.
So for anyone keen to learn more about our infrastructure of calcified collagen, this is Bone Up.
Hello, and welcome back to another episode of Bone Up the Podcast. I should apologise, I'm just getting over the cold, so you might detect in my voice that my usual mellifluous tone is a little more plangent. Richie, how are you? How are you doing?
I'm good, thanks, I'm good. I've also got a bit of a cold at the minute. I think all the kids are back in school and the students are back in uni, so it's like infection centre, isn't it, really? I'm really excited about today's episode because I think it cuts across science and clinical practice, and I think we've got a lot of really interesting stuff for the listeners today. But I suppose a good place to start is to ask you, David, how have you found that your clinical practice has changed in the last decade or so?
Yeah, I mean, it's something a number of us in clinical practice have been talking about recently, and that is how what you might call an osteoporosis clinic or a fracture liaison clinic has changed so much over the last 10 years. And the single biggest change is that whereas maybe 10 years ago, 1 in 10 or 2 in 10 of my patients might have had vertebral fractures and be seeing me because they'd had a vertebral fracture, at most clinics now, it's 8 out of 10 or 9 out of 10. And indeed, I think like many specialists, I now run a specific fast-track vertebral fracture clinic where obviously it's 10 out of 10. And vertebral fractures have really moved front and center. And that's a huge change. You know, even when I think back to, you know, the first time I did an osteoporosis clinic as a junior doctor back in the late 1990s, you would seldom have seen a vertebral fracture. You know, they were considered really very much small print and incidental things. And I suppose the biggest reason for them moving front and center, first, of course, we understand that they are a very strong predictor for other fractures and a very strong predictor for high fracture risk and for low bone density and for osteoporosis. But we actually have medication now that can make a big difference to them. You know, because as we've talked before, those first clinics I did 25 years ago, we had oral bisphosphonate, that was quite a novelty. And those drugs, while good drugs in many scenarios, they take their time to work. And in terms of you know, vertebral fractures, we now have newer, exciting drugs which work much more quickly and are much more effective. And that's probably been the single biggest change. And that's why, you know, it's one of the reasons it's exciting today to talk to Roland Baron about his role in the development of one of those drugs. And in fact, just his experience over many, many years of working in the field of osteoporosis and the changes that he has seen. And, you know, it's also really been brought home to me recently, Richie, just how important that this is. I know our podcast, it's quite a modest little enterprise, but we do think we're putting proper evidence-based medicine out there in a way that people can understand. Quite recently, I had a patient came in and really didn't want to listen to anything I had to say. I'd read things on the internet and was very much against any sort of modern pharmaceutical medicine, felt the drugs we were giving were sort of causing fractures. And while, you know, I'm respectful of her, I gave her the evidence, we decided to disagree and she left, I hope on good terms. But it brought it home to me how still, you know, there's work to be done in getting this new medicine, this new evidence, getting it out there so people can look at it and so people can make hopefully a, an informed decision about what's best for them. And it's so nice to hear the science discussed as well, and to hear people who were really there at the coalface when the science started, like Roland, to tell us about what that was like. Now, one of the things you're going to hear, listeners, is Roland talk about the WNT pathway. And I think it might be useful to get a bit of an update. And I think, Richie, you're probably very well placed to explain to us exactly what the WNT pathway is and how it's relevant to our bones and how it's relevant to the medication we would use.
Listeners, as David said, Roland is really instrumental in developing new medicines, the anabolic medicines like romosozumab. Roland and his contemporaries were able to characterize the cell signaling pathways which govern bone formation in our bodies, and then develop treatments that increase the amount of cell signaling to improve bone mass. And the cell signaling pathway for bone formation is called WNT, which is spelt W-N-T. And in our bodies, we have a gene called WNT that produces the protein called WNT. And that protein travels to our bone cells and it stimulates them to form new bone. One of the new treatments in the UK now, romosozumab, works by activating that WNT pathway to tell the bone cells to form new bone. WNT is a slightly odd word, and really it's an abbreviation. And the abbreviation stands for wingless integrated. Wingless integrated. And the reason why it's called wingless is really fascinating. The gene is called wingless because it was discovered by accident in the 1970s by scientists who were studying wingless fruit flies. And they realized that WNT genes in our body control really fundamental processes of growth and development, including bone. Ultimately, the new drugs that are being licensed now originally came from discoveries that were made by scientists in the 70s studying fruit flies.
I can't pretend I knew that, Richie. That's that is very interesting.
I promised you I'd have something good for you today.
We often say how proteins and diseases and all these things are named sometimes many, many years before the mechanism or the usefulness is worked out. And if we had to name them now, we would name them something completely different. But we're stuck with names like tumor necrosis factor alpha and you know, WNT and so on. So yeah, fascinating little story.
Right. I suppose we should get to our interview now. And listeners, we caught up with Roland Baron at the ECTS conference early this year, which was an absolute mine for interviews for Bone Up. So I hope you enjoy.
So listeners, we're very excited with our next guest. We have Roland Baron, Harvard professor. Welcome.
Thank you. I'm very pleased to be here.
Back home in France?
Back home in France, absolutely.
Marseille is a beautiful city. We're really enjoying the conference here. So first question for you, how did you get into bone?
Oh my God, I got into bone because I was, as a kid and even until my early 20s, passionate about archaeology and prehistoric digs. And I was very lucky to participate in within a professional team from the Musée de l'Homme in Paris, a very famous professor, my first big mentor, Professor Leroy Gourand, very, very famous. We ended up encountering a lot of bones, animal bones in some sites, and human bones in Neolithic common graves, mm-hmm. where slowly I became the guy to look at these bones, decide whether there was, you know, pathology or no pathology, whether it was an old man or a young woman.
Yeah.
Or a kid or all of that. And slowly I discovered that what I was passionate about was really research. And that was one type of research. And then I started to do biology during my education and so on. And I married the two, from the dead bone to the live bone.
Yeah. I worked at the Musée de l'Homme for a month
in
2011.
Yeah, I used to go there all the time.
Oh, it's a beautiful museum and a wonderful location by the Eiffel Tower.
Also.
You got into basic and clinical research for bone health. And you've been studying the physiological mechanisms that control bone cells, your osteoblasts, your osteoclasts, your osteocytes. And you've done lots of really fundamental work into how the systems work. And one of your most important bits of research would be the Wnt pathway and Wnt signaling. Could you tell us about your research?
Yeah, so my research from the beginning was centered on trying to understand the mechanisms of bone remodeling and more recently bone modeling as well, which implied not only understanding the origin and differentiation and function of the different cells involved, and you listed them, osteoclasts, osteoblasts, osteocytes, although it's only recently that we are able to do some work with that cell type, and the lining cells, the quiescent surfaces. So a lot of my work originally was on understanding the remodeling process, the crosstalk and so on, and going more in depth in cell biology, I mostly worked on osteoclasts, to say the truth. And there, we made some important observations at the time, like the fact that the cells acidify the extracellular environment, things like that. And the coupling phenomenon and how to approach it and so on. And how these processes were disrupted during pathological processes. Wnt came late in the story, really. It came when I was 1 foot in academia and 1 foot in industry. Decided, as industry at the time, to focus on ultra-rare diseases, really, which now is like we're all doing that. But at the time, it was not the case. And we had identified the group of Matt Warman, who was working on osteoporosis pseudoglioma syndrome, ultra-rare disease, and was trying to identify the gene that was mutated in that early onset osteoporosis, you want to call it. And it turned out that a team in France, actually here nearby in Nice, was an expert of the chromosomal region that Matt had identified in humans, so the syntenic region in mice, that Matt had identified in humans. But in order to find the mutated gene at the time, because it was late 90s, early 2000, you needed to know a lot of marker genes. And this group in Nice had really a tremendous knowledge of the syntenic region in the mouse chromosome. And with all the markers that they had identified, Matt, within 6 months, was able to identify the mutated gene, which was LRP5. It turned out that LRP5, first time we heard about it in our field, is one of the co-receptors for canonical Wnt signaling. And that triggered, not only in my lab and in my company, but also in the world, a tremendous amount of research. So we collaborated with Matt to understand how this receptor was linked to bone, development and biology and so on. We ended up publishing together a paper that is cited tremendously, that is was in Cell. So,
Biggest journal in the world.
Yeah. And the only thing is we are, I don't know, 150 authors or something like that. The last three is myself and Bjorn Olsson and Matt. The three labs that were collaborating. And I always blamed Matt for doing that to us, because what he did was to include as co-authors all the clinicians that gave him blood samples from the ultra-rare patients.
Yeah.
So it was the way it is. And from there, a lot of my personal research, academic research, turned to try to understand the mechanisms by which all this was happening and the biology of this quite complex pathway.
Most clinicians, and I'm a clinician, will have heard of WNT, W-N-T, in terms of anti-sclerostin antibody and treatment for osteoporosis.
It came to that.
From your point of view, did you perceive in the early stages that this was a potential pathway for a game-changing treatment?
Oh,
or was it purely interest in the science?
Well, it was a mix. It was a mix. As I said, my interest came from my small company at the time. So there was an industrial interest, if you want, trying to find new targets for the treatment of bone fragility, whatever the cause is. So there was that. But quickly, it also became academically extremely interesting. It's a very fundamental pathway and very complex, which, by the way, explains why with romosozumab you get these changes, but they are very quickly counteracted by negative feedback loops, because it's a very potent primordial pathway. So initially, we didn't know about sclerostin, but often when I give my lectures on this topic, I call the attention of the fact that in the history of medicine, it's quite rare that in the same year, three papers came out. So we had that one, the early onset osteoporosis. Then, what's his name? Bob Recker. In Omaha, had identified a family with high bone mass, but no clinical consequences of it, just high bone mass. Normal guys, but high bone mass. And they went also to identify the gene, and it turned out to also be LRP5. And their paper came about 1 year after us, but they were engaged into that long before. And it's fascinating that in human, not in mouse mutation and all of that. Within 1 year or a year and a half, you identify the gain of function that leads to high bone mass and the loss of function that led to low bone mass.
Coincidence, just at the same year, both those
things
appeared.
And
the
third paper is even more incredibly in the history of medicine, in my mind, was the paper from Wim van Hool and the group in the Netherlands that identified the gene causing sclerosteosis, which, as you know, is sclerostin. And lo and behold, the mutations in the high bone mass was a single point mutation in the receptor that led, in LRP5 receptor, that led to a low affinity for sclerostin. Explaining the whole story.
All the jigsaw pieces suddenly appeared in the same year.
Absolutely, absolutely.
And were you talking to each other among the groups? Did you all know you were all working on sclerostin?
No, nobody knew. No, we were trying to do one thing, they were trying to do something else. And it turned out that the three things are the full explanation of the whole story. That is, that this pathway is essential in bone mass regulation.
Do you get a thrill when you see know that people around the world are now getting a drug which has changed their lives based on something that you
that
you
do?
You know, I see patients and their lives have been changed by getting romosuzumab, and it's thanks to the work that you did 20 years ago.
It's not just me.
But you were a big part of this.
We were a part of it, and that's very rewarding. Yeah. Absolutely. And you know, when I left industry, of course, companies that were working all of that called on me to you know, be an advisor. Mm-hmm. So I've been on the SAB of all these development, and romosuzumab story is fascinating from the basic science, the clinical, and drug development. Side.
Even the history of sclerosteosis as a condition and the groups of people that affected. And
you know, when this paper came out on sclerosteosis, I don't remember if it's the original paper, probably it is. Mm-hmm. There was also heterozygotes, haploinsufficient.
Yeah.
So this told the whole industry that if we can regulate sclerostin, mm-hmm. we don't need to be zero.
Yeah,
you just we need to be 50% or 60 or 70 or whatever. We will increase bone density. Yeah, the surprise has been two things. One, that when the first, especially the clinical trials, when phase one was done in particular, suddenly we realized that it's also anti-resorbing.
Mm-hmm.
That was not clear from the preclinical studies or the.
That's very interesting because you know we do think of it as a dual. We lump it together
it
as an anabolic therapy, but it's not. It's a dual action.
No, it's a dual action.
Yeah,
absolutely. Yeah.
So you didn't know that from the start. That's something you discovered as you went. So there's even an extra benefit.
Yeah,
absolutely. That's amazing.
It was discovered really after the phase one, when we saw the phase one data. It was wow, because we didn't see that before. Yeah. Yeah. And the second surprise is not a good one, that one, is the fact that it's the effect is very limited in time.
Mm.
You know, after 6 months, you're back to baseline, basically, in terms of bone formation.
Yeah. But in that time, you can build a tremendous amount of bone.
Mm-hmm.
Which is going to reduce people's fracture risk.
Tremendous. I mean, the clinical trials are very demonstrative of that. Yeah.
Honestly, I'm sure a lot of patients prefer just to take it for a few months.
Yeah.
At what point did you realize what a game changer this was? At what point did you think, wow, we're going to help a lot of people?
Well, I think that, you know, the early animal studies, you know, the knockout, or the first preclinical studies with the antibodies and so on, it was clear that, you know, the tremendous impact on both cortical and trabecular bone and the speed at which it happened was unique. I remember seeing the first data from Amgen, you know, where you see, you know, double fluorescent label along bone surface, like 100% of the surfaces.
Yeah.
We had never seen that before.
A lot of treatments which are being developed and tested in mice, though, never make it to humans because it doesn't really extrapolate to humans. Were you ever worried that although it was working in mice, it might not work in humans?
No, because I remind you that it all started from human.
Yeah, you have the sclerosteosis to prove that,
This is a reverse. It's not like we worked in mice and then tried in humans. It was discovered, the entire story, in human. And then we went in mice to use them as a tool, not to figure how it works.
Wow. For young scientists listening, this is a really amazing example of how to do research.
No, it was.
Back from humans.
Yeah.
We know you've done some work on osteocytes as well.
More recently. I'm not known for that.
Oh, I was going to ask you some hard questions. I'll ask you simple questions
about it. You can go because we
we talk to students and I talk to patients and I explain to them how osteoblasts work and how osteoclasts work. We don't talk that much about osteocytes, even though they are by far the most abundant cell in the bone, much more
supposedly
common than osteoblasts or osteoclasts. And we are discovering more about how they work and how they live in their lacuna. And they respond, I think, to mechanical loading. quite well. Do you think the time will come we will develop specific drugs and pathways and mechanisms to manipulate osteocytes specifically? Or do you think we will just come to understand how the drugs we use affect osteocytes?
Yeah. So let me answer that question by going back to sclerosin. You have to remember that the only source we know of within the bone microenvironment, at least, but really mostly in the whole body, but let's say within bone, is the osteocyte.
Mm-hmm.
So the story is an osteocyte story.
Mm-hmm.
We know these molecules work at very short range. So it is one of the, Rank ligand being, of course, one of the others, cytokines that the osteocyte make.
Yeah.
To regulate the activity of cells along the bone surface. Right?
Osteoblast,
so
that gives you.
So in a way, you could say, no, you cannot say it too seriously, but you know, to some degree, that with romosozumab we are targeting the osteocyte.
Osteocyte, yeah.
Okay. Now, strange enough, we do not know much, and I always think that would be interesting to look at that. We don't know much about what romosozumab, for instance, does to the biology of the osteocyte itself.
Mm-hmm.
It would be an interesting, at least academic, question to address.
Do you think if we did understand that, we may, for example, use romosozumab slightly differently? If we understood just how it worked in the osteocyte, we might be able to tweak it in some way to make it...
Not romosozumab, but we know now that the other dominant Wnt antagonist in the bone microenvironment is also made primarily by the osteocytes. It's a DKK1,
DKOF.
And we also know that when we treat with romosozumab, it's primarily, not only, but primarily DKK1 that serves as a negative feedback loop.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, it because the system perceives that Wnt is too much activated, the cells make DKK1 to block it.
And so that's why the effect goes off so quickly, because
goes up. Exactly. And so Amgen made bispecific antibodies where one arm is against sclerostin, the other against DKK1. And the effect is even more spectacular. Turns out that they were already very much engaged in the development of denosumab, romosozumab, excuse me.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, you know, from an industry point of view, you don't stop. However, there is a company that picked up on that and that I think just made a phase one. So
of just a DKK1 blocker or one that does both sclerostin and DKK1?
Exactly.
Wow. Okay.
Exactly. And I mean, in mice anyway, we know that when you do that, you increase like double the speed and the amount of bone. However, it also fades out. Fades out because we know of, 10 or 12 Wnt antagonists, and the system, each time you're going to turn on...
Yeah, it will escape somewhere else. That's we've really got to see behind the curtain here of the future. This is very exciting.
We're going to include this as part of the ECTS conference
episode. Yeah, but
I think we need a separate episode for this. This is too good. So basically, if I understand you right, then you're saying that there's going to be another medicine in the pipeline which might be even more potent and even better than
romosozumab.
Wow, patients will be very
absolutely.
Yeah,
happy
that is exciting. And I suppose then the question will be, because I don't know if we have time to get into the cardiovascular question with the romosozumab.
We can talk about it. I'm not an expert on that. However, I was close to the project as an advisor. What I can say is, first of all, if you look in the literature about sclerostin and atherosclerosis, or for instance, you find essentially whatever you want. So some people reported that it is increased in atherosclerosis. Some people say that it is decreased. Some people say that when it's increased and you block it, you make things worse. Mm-hmm. Some people say that you do the opposite. The Amgen UCB group did very extensive studies with the animal models that are available. You know, they are not perfect. And have not found any link between sclerostin and atherosclerosis. Okay. Mm-hmm. Add to that that in the very extensive animal studies and so on, there's never been any indication that, that there is really something. At the recent meeting last year, there was a whole discussion on the topic. And one interesting question is what it does to vascular calcification, and whether by enhancing bone formation, as we do, we also favor vascular calcification, which could be part of cardiovascular issues. But as you know, the consensus in the field so far is that we do not know of a direct link between the two. So we are waiting to see. And again, I'm not a clinician, but in Japan, where romosozumab is used extensively, they've done
post-marketing
research. And so far, there's absolutely no signal of an increase in strokes. Or
because certainly as a practicing osteoporosis doctor, I'm obviously obliged to talk through people. And occasionally I've had one or two patients who don't want to take romosozumab. And there are people who I don't think have any significant cardiovascular risk. Yeah. And I'm disappointed because I don't really think it's a risk for them, or I think the relative relative risk is a different, a different degree.
Absolutely.
But at the moment, we still feel we have to share these, which is good. That's fair. But perhaps in the longer term, that perception will fall away, and we'll be able to use the drug more widely.
But of course, you have to put yourself in the shoes of the patient.
Yeah, exactly.
Which is that you're putting one side. I'm going to prevent potential future fractures.
Exactly.
Yet I may induce a stroke. So it's kind of
It's difficult, and we have to be entirely fair and open all the time with people. But that's why it's really good for us to come and talk to scientists and talk about research, so that my patients know that the advice I'm giving them comes from proper science, proper research. Absolutely. I'm not being told by someone. I'm not making it up. Absolutely. It's all based on clever people doing their best to understand how the body works.
So think about the story of Terry Pahatide and now Abalo and osteosarcoma.
Yeah.
Well, so it took 20 years on the market before the black box was removed.
And that's something I don't feel I have to talk to people about now because it just... when you did have to, it put almost everyone off it. Yeah, imagine.
Of course, so my prediction, but it's always dangerous to make prediction, is that it's going to happen with Romo.
I think a lot of people hope that will happen,
A while ago, I took a deep dive into the clinical trial data, and when Romo was compared to a placebo, there was no cardiovascular signal. Mm-hmm. When it was compared to alendronate, there was, but that might say more about the effect of alendronate and its potential ability to reduce cardiovascular side effects.
Right, there is that, and there is, the randomness of clinical trials.
Yeah.
Because even on the alendronate arm, there are weird events. If you look at the Kaplan-Meier curve, for the first 3 months, there's zero events.
Yeah.
And then between 1, 6 and 9, again, zero events, which is extremely unlikely.
It's unusual. Yeah, absolutely. Unlikely. Yeah, I must say, I've always tended to feel it could well have been the bisphosphonate being protective, that it's not a pure placebo group. It's a slightly treated group. Yeah, that's...
Yeah, yeah. There's been some discussion. And also the patients were, if I recall, 4 or 5 years older on average.
Yeah.
And they already had one fracture.
Yeah.
So it's a different population between the frame and the arch clinical trials.
Okay. We're going to have to draw it to a close. Thank you so much for talking to us.
My pleasure.
It has been a huge honor for you to join our podcast.
My pleasure.
And I mean, we look forward. You were central to developing Actonel, resedronate. You had this major role in developing romosuzumab. You need a third one now before you retire, Shirley. You're working on a third one before you retire.
And you started the IFMRS. We spoke to
Federico. And you absolutely. We haven't even had time to cover that. You founder of the IFMRS. What a contribution you've made to millions of people with osteoporosis around the world.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I hope it's not the end, but it might be.
David, I really enjoyed interviewing Roland. I felt like we were kind of in the presence of greatness. What were your takeaways?
Yeah, it's. I mean, if you're outside the world of osteoporosis and research, you don't realize just what an important figure Roland has been for many years internationally. We were very honored that he came to speak to us. Do you know, the single biggest thing really I came away with from speaking to Roland was just his enthusiasm for the subject, and the reason he did what he did was that he was interested in it. And I find that chimed very much with me, in that I do bone because I'm interested in bone and because I enjoy, you know, seeing people with bone problems at clinics and being a doctor in that way. And Roland told us how he started out, he had an interest in archaeology and paleontology and bones, and he just followed that where his genuine interest took him, and it led him to be part of, you know, some major discoveries which have changed the lives of, you know, tens of millions of people around the world. And I think for anyone, you know, for any sort of early career grade person, whether they're a scientist, whether they're a doctor, whether they're a radiographer, whatever they're doing, you know, if it interests you, then follow it. You know, that's what to do, because that's what'll give you a fulfilling professional life. And, you know, in Roland's case, allow you to make a huge difference to people around the world. And again, it's just, I really enjoy learning about the basic science of things, and you'd be surprised perhaps how much time I do spend sometimes talking to patients about basic science, because I think patients are interested to learn how their bodies work, and I have no doubt that if you understand how a drug works, you are more likely to take it, more likely to comply with it, more likely to have confidence in it, you know. And it surprises me almost sometimes when I find myself explaining to patients, you know, in some depth about how cells work. Patients are fascinated by that. They you know, they love to hear that. And, you know, it's one of the privileges of doing this podcast, actually, is to get to talk to the people who do this work. People like you, Richie, as well, who do the really important basic science work. And to be able to share that with the people who will benefit from hearing it. I'm sure as a scientist and as a Wnt pathway fan, as we now know, you must have found that very interesting.
Yeah, it was amazing. Over the years, I've read about the Wnt pathway so much. It was fascinating to talk to Roland about it and how the discovery came about. And I thought he was so, like, listeners, it's hard to get across how transformative Roland has been. The discovery of the Wnt pathway has led to lots of new treatments, and those new treatments, like romosozumab, use monoclonal antibodies. And monoclonal antibodies were kind of discovered in the late 1990s, and it was thought straight away that they could be a very good tool for treating many, many, many diseases. But it was in bone that Roland and his contemporaries were able to make it work. So this is like discovery upon discovery, and it really shows that bone research is actually very cutting edge in comparison to many other fields. And I don't think we get that message out to the wider world enough. One of the things that I really liked about Roland was his story. Like you were saying, he just has a love for the subject. He came from archaeology. And I find that really fascinating because I came from archaeology and paleontology as well. And I suppose, you know, you kind of get excited about bone and bone physiology. And in a way, that kind of leads you towards the more medical aspects and towards medical research. I was really kind of heartened to see how he talked to not just about himself and his own research, but the other groups who were working at the same time and making similar discoveries that overlapped with his, and talking about how several groups released papers in the same year and they didn't know they were all working on it. But when you put all that work together, then you can unlock the secrets of these bone pathways. And I thought that was really amazing. It's a community of people that have led to these new treatments. The other thing is, listeners, you know, you heard it here first, you know, these new medicines that will work to increase new bone formation by also targeting the Dickhoff pathways. Roland talked about new medicines which are in development that could target the Wnt and Dickhoff at the same time, and therefore, I guess, be much more potent medicines for preventing osteoporosis and preventing fractures, which is absolutely amazing. Roland's been such a massive figure in our field for so long, and he's still coming out with the big hits. It's amazing.
It's one of the things patients say to me, well, you know, this is great, but you know, what's next? Is there anything in the pipeline? And it's great to be able to learn that there are things in the pipeline. And I suppose one of the questions people sometimes say, the teriparatide or the abaloparatide or the romosozumab, it's worked really well for me for 12 months, 18 months. Why can't I just keep going with it for 5 years or 10 years the way I did with the bisphosphonate? But the effects of all those drugs wear off. And, mm-hmm. and you know, the Dickhoff pathway, as we're talking about, that may be a secret to preventing the wearing off effect of romosozumab, if I understand that correctly. And it's certainly very exciting. You know, we've had two episodes talking about new drugs in the last 2 years. I don't think we anticipate having a third new drug very soon, but it is fascinating to sort of learn where the, you know, from what direction the new developments might be coming, and give people the hope that that there are even newer things around the corner.
Ever better and better treatments.
Absolutely.
Okay, listeners, we hope you've enjoyed the show today. We really did. See you again soon. Bye-bye.
Bye now.